Welcome to Central Standard. I'm Bill Anderson. Our guest today is a Pulitzer Prize winning author, Jared Diamond. He's also an award-winning scientist whose research informs his written work. His field work takes him to jungles and other locations where he's done in-depth research on birds and human societies. His latest book takes us, at least initially, to a much different place, an airport in New Guinea. More on an appearance he's making in Kansas City through Rainy Day Books in a few minutes. But first, good morning, Dr. Diamond.
Good morning, and how are you?
Well, I'm doing well. It's great to host you this morning.
I'm glad to be with you.
Your newest bestseller is called The World Until Yesterday, What We Can Learn from Traditional Societies. I think we can find at least a partial understanding of the title through an experience you had in 2006 at a New Guinea airport. You compared that experience to a photograph of that airport some 75 years earlier. Could you explain?
Yes, I do field work in New Guinea, going out in and out of the main airport in the capital city of Port Moresby. And when I went through there in 2006, it struck me I was in a perfectly normal airport with baggage checkers and security and police and computer terminals at the counter. But I had been through that airport myself 50 years ago when it consisted of two wooden rooms and the capital city had no traffic light. And just 30 years before that, Europeans for the first time had come into the central highlands of New Guinea and discovered to their great surprise a million people living with stone tools, New Guineans unaware of the existence of the outside world. So things have changed in New Guinea very rapidly with modernization in this century.
Well, you point out that they changed within a generation or two.
I've had cases. I remember an occasion when I was sitting in an oil exploration field, and in the next room to me was a New Guinean sitting at a computer, which I can't handle anyway, and he was working on engineering diagrams, which I didn't understand, and it turned out that he was from the tribe that I worked with in 1964 and that he was the son of the first person in that area who had learned to write. So there, within one generation, we leapfrog from inability to write to the ability to handle computers and engineering diagrams that are far beyond me.
Just to give a little additional context, dress was different in the 1931 photo. Many were wearing grass skirts, but it does go deeper than appearance. There were no manufactured goods to speak of, and I'm talking about clocks, phones, and as you point out, technology like computers. They lacked money. They lacked schools. I think there was an absence of centralized government, which leads me to the next question. In some 75 years, New Guinea highland population went through changes that took most of the rest of the world thousands of years to make. Tell us about that.
That's true. In the rest of the world, the first government in world history, the first king, was something like 5,500 years ago in the Fertile Crescent of the Mideast. And since then, we, that's to say in the West, have gradually acquired kings and writing and metal tools and organized religion. So these things have crept on gradually over 5,000 years. But in New Guinea, these changes in an isolated society that didn't know of the outside world and didn't have steel tools, just stone tools, these changes have been compressed into one or two generations. And that's interesting because without knowing anything about it, you might have thought that it requires genetic change in order for people to learn how to write. But no, it doesn't. You take a population that has never had writing and you start teaching them to write, and within 3 weeks they can read the Bible.
So this is what makes New Guinea such a good research subject for human evolution and for lessons, I presume, both good and bad?
There are many reasons that make New Guinea a good research subject. One is that it's a fascinating place with a thousand different tribes, all different from each other. So it's like a thousand experiments in running a human society, a thousand experiments in figuring out how to raise children and treat old people. Another reason why New Guinea is so instructive is that the entire world until 10,000 years ago consisted of people in tribal societies at low population density without technology. And that was still the case in outlying areas of New Guinea within this century, and it still is the case for a few isolated remaining tribes in New Guinea today.
So, Dr. Diamond, if nothing else, give me a couple of takeaways from this experience you had. How do I apply this to my life in 2013? How significant is this to the rest of us?
Well, one really practical takeaway is to help you stay alive. That's to say, most of us, you, I, and most of us in the United States, will die of non-communicable diseases such as type 2 diabetes, heart disease, stroke, and cancers. And in traditional New Guinea, not a single person died of these diseases until the Western lifestyle arrived within the last few decades, and then within a short time, New Guineans too start dying of them, all of which means that it's factors in our lifestyle that kill most of us, and we know what those factors are. They include too much salt intake. The average American consumes in one day as much salt as a New Guinean in 200 days, so there goes your high blood pressure. And sugar and not enough fiber and just eating too much and not exercising. So there are plenty of Americans who have learned about the advantages of that traditional lifestyle and adopted it and protected themselves against heart disease, stroke, and so on. That's a practical advantage.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about food production and how that informs your research, not necessarily diet, but I was taken by the fact that you kind of put food production in the context of population size.
That's right. Food production was the starting point for the population explosion of 10,000 years ago. Until throughout human history, so humans split off from chimpanzees about 6 million years ago, and throughout human history, humans were hunters and gatherers, eating wild foods, killing wild animals, gathering wild plants. And it's only about 10,000 years ago that the first experiments with agriculture arose, producing food. That's to say, the first foods produced were wheat and barley. But once you start to grow your own food, then every plant in an acre is edible instead of there being an occasional edible plant in the forest. So there's just more food and you can get lots more people, with the result that the United States today has about 310 million citizens, whereas the United States, say, 2,000 years ago, might have had 1 million people. That's the population explosion due to agriculture, which requires kings and government and bureaucrats, all those things that we hate. Once you get 310 million people, you can't make a decision face to face.
Later this hour, in light of the high-profile investigation of the Miami Dolphins NFL franchise, workplace behavior and adult bullies. It's Central Standard on KCUR, but first we continue our conversation with Dr. Jared Diamond. You have an interesting story about a child you met in New Guinea, born to a family living in a culture where children had very restrictive and demanding lives. And he moved away at age 5, and he moved to another tribe and village, and I want you to pick it up at that point.
This story illustrates the enormous diversity of traditional tribal societies. We think of the United States and China as being different, but the reality is that every society with a central government, whether it's American, Chinese, Israeli, or Argentinian, once you have a government, all governments demand similar things. They demand obedience, they want to administer justice, they want children to be brought up and kept alive, they don't want you to go around killing old people. But in traditional societies without centralized government, there's much more diversity. And so one New Guinea friend of mine, one of the first New Guineans that I met, happened to have grown up in a really repressive tribal society where children were under severe pressure, and he got sick of it. So at age 5, he walked across the river to another group where he had relatives, and he found himself in a tribe that was extremely permissive, where children could do whatever they want, including babies if they wanted, playing with or playing near fire. So on the one hand, this illustrates the great diversity of tribal societies, which means thousands of experiments from which we can learn, but it also illustrates the predominant pattern of child rearing in traditional societies, which is what we would call laid back. That's to say, mm-hmm. you do not spank children. You let kids do what they want and learn from their mistakes.
Well, in fact, you even mentioned that a lot of the adults had scars from burns from childhood because the society was so permissive.
That struck me early. When I started to work in the New Guinea Highlands, I noticed that most people had scars on their arms, fire scars. And this is a cold climate where people heat themselves with fires and they sit around fires. I at first thought that these fire scars were incurred in adulthood with people lighting fires. But no, the fire scars were mostly acquired in childhood or already as babies because children are allowed to do what they want, include to play near fires and to play with knives. And the adults have the attitude that you're going to be responsible for yourself for the rest of your life. You better learn at the beginning, and so it's for babies to figure out to stay away from fires. That degree of permissiveness goes far beyond what I practiced, but my wife and I did learn from New Guineans and left our children as much freedom of decision as possible, short of playing with fires and big shot knives.
Yeah, certainly. I think children represent about half of the world's population. Am I correct there?
That's right.
Okay.
Kids under, say, 18 are about half the world's population, which means that if, like many sociologists, you go out to a group and you say, I studied the group, it turns out they studied the adults over the age 25, and you've missed half the population.
So what you talked about what you learned about parenting from their example, but I have a question of curiosity. Do their children struggle with rebellion just as much as ours here in America?
No, and that's interesting. Adolescent crises are endemic in the United States. Teenagers, the reality is that teenagers acquire the bodies of adults without having acquired the decision-making experience of adults because we micromanage our kids and we tell them what they do at 3 o'clock and 4 o'clock and 5 o'clock, whereas in New Guinea, children make their own decisions, including negotiating with adults. And so by the time a New Guinea kid has reached teenage years, the New Guinea kid has also been negotiating and making its own decisions, and therefore there's not an adolescent rebellion.
Mm-hmm. This leads us to early childhood development, which in recent years, at least in America, has been given a lot of attention and a lot of money, a lot of focus. Most studies dwell on narrow modern samples, but I think you probably argue that it's important to look at past cultures and traditional societies as we kind of develop and grow our early childhood programs.
That's true. The ways of bringing up children in advanced societies. So if you read a paper on child rearing in a psychology journal and they say this is a comparative study of societies around the world and then you look at it, the comparative study is usually based on undergraduate university students majoring in psychology in countries with state governments and coinage. That's a really narrow slice of humanity, much narrower than if you look at African and South American, Indian and New Guinean traditional societies, which have much more variety in what they do with their children.
You know, we have so much to cover here but I feel like I need to ask you one more question as it relates to raising children. Would you argue that the children in New Guinea, for example, assume traditional gender roles?
Do the children in New Guinea assume traditional gender roles?
Yes.
Again, there's great diversity there. If by traditional gender roles you mean monogamous heterosexual gender roles, the first group that I work with in New Guinea in the highlands of eastern New Guinea had a gender role arrangement that's widespread in the eastern highlands, and that is that the men, adult men, live together in a communal man's house. The wives, each wife lived in a separate hut together with the children up to age 6. And at age 6, the boy children moved into the communal men's hut where they had a homosexual male society until at teenage, the boy who had until then been told that women are disgusting, dirty, and defiling. At teenage, the boy is suddenly told, you're going to get married tomorrow, and here's how you have sex with this creature that you've been taught is filthy until now. And somehow they make the transition and then carry on heterosexual as well as adult-child homosexual relations.
Author, professor, scientist Jared Diamond is with us on KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Bill Anderson. We're talking about things we can learn from traditional societies. His latest book is called The World Until Yesterday. And later this hour, we're going to be talking about adult bullies. Your chapter on the treatment of old people puts it in pretty frank terms, Doctor. Cherish, abandon, or kill?
Those are the choices among traditional societies where there aren't governments and Social Security to run old people's homes. In some traditional societies, and a few of them, societies of hunter-gatherers and societies in the deserts, there's no choice except when food is scarce, you have to ration, and the people who get abandoned or actively killed are the old people. But in most traditional societies, there is enough food much of the time. People are settled down, and so old people live out their lives surrounded by their friends of childhood and their relatives, which means that old people in traditional societies have a much more satisfying life than in the United States, where, frankly, old age is a disaster area of modern American society. We move on the average every 5 years. So, of course, older people are certain to end up far removed from the friends of their childhood and often removed from their children, whom they may see once a week or once a year.
Well, one could make an argument that many of us do abandon our elderly citizens, our parents.
That argument was made bluntly, you're very right, by a Fijian friend of mine, a man from the Fiji Islands in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, who had been to the United States. So I asked him what he thought of the United States. He told me what he liked less, and what he loathed about the United States was he almost shouted to me, "You throw your old people away." And by that he meant what you just said, namely that old people often or usually end up in retirement homes separate from their families. And if they're lucky, their children visit them once a week, whereas in New Guinea, they would be living in the same hut or in the hut next to their children.
The argument, though, is life, work dictates so much from us and mandates so much from us that it becomes really difficult and incredibly expensive to care for the elderly, and some people simply don't have the means, Doctor.
You are absolutely right, and the more general point about which you're right is that it's not always easy to adopt practices that we like in traditional societies. Some may strike us as good, but they're hard to adopt, but some are really easy to adopt. And an example of a really easy one is how you carry your baby. In the United States, we used to push babies in baby carriages with the baby horizontal. Mm-hmm. Well, all traditional societies carry their babies vertically upright, facing forwards, not backwards. And that means that the baby is brought up with the same field of view as the person carrying the baby, so the baby develops self-confidence and neuromotor skills. That's something that you can do regardless of whether your neighbors are doing it and regardless of technology.
Do you find yourself getting, based on your experience and your research and spending a lot of time in traditional societies, that the good qualities, you so much want to share them with the Western world that it becomes incredibly frustrating for you because we tend to move slowly?
No, it doesn't become frustrating. The fact is I choose to live in California and visit New Guinea. I don't choose to live in New Guinea and visit California because I like medical care and education and the opportunity to travel. But in my book, I try to do two things. One, to show just how fascinating these traditional societies are with people like ourselves but so different from ourselves. And also, I lay out the range of the things they do, some of which I personally have found wonderful to incorporate into my own life. And maybe my readers and listeners will also find some of those things valuable to worth incorporating into their own lives.
You're currently a professor at UCLA. What do you do? How do you find time to relax, and what do you do to relax?
What do I do to relax? Every morning I get up at 6 a.m. and I take a bird walk of 1 or 2 hours from my house, because I'm in a dead-end canyon in Santa Monica Mountains near UCLA.
Oh, delightful.
Other things I do to relax is that in front of me at the moment, while I was waiting to talk to you, is a book in Italian, Guerra negli Abissi, on Italian submarines in World War II. So I read Italian every day for fun. I spend lots
for
of time
fun,
naturally.
Doctor.
For fun. Oh, it really is interesting to read about Italian submarines. And I spend time talking to my wife, and then I spend time teaching my students and reading about my next book, because each next book is always about whatever I'm most curious about at the moment.
And you play the piano, I understand.
I play the piano. I've got a wonderful violinist and a wonderful violist with whom I play violin sonatas and viola sonatas.
We're running out of time here, but I want to hear your observations about something I saw on TED Talk. You talked about a 5-point framework for understanding societal collapses. Could you talk briefly about them and start with environment?
Sure. My 2005 book was called Collapse. It was about why some societies, fortunately not all, end up collapsing, past examples being the Maya and the Anasazi and the Easter Islanders. And I worked out a 5-point framework for understanding the reasons of collapse, starting with environmental problems. That's to say, all societies make environmental mistakes and unfortunately may overuse resources on which they depend, such as, think of today, water and fossil fuels and forests and fisheries. We are clobbering our fisheries. So there's item number one. Item number two is climate change in the past that undermines societies, but that's happening today.
Yes.
Item number three is problems with your trade partners in the past. We've got that today. Item number four is problems with your enemies in the past. We've got that today. And problem number five is one's social, political, and economic responses. And there are plenty of problems with those in the United States today, all of which illustrates that we can learn from those past societies that collapsed and hopefully run things right today so that we won't collapse in the next 50 years.
Would you say that the political, economic, social, and cultural factors that you talk about, is that something we should be tackling globally, or should we be dealing with that here at home?
All of those things. It's something mm-hmm. that we should be tackling in the United States as a nation. It should be something that we are tackling at the local level. For example, I'm from Los Angeles. In the last mayor's election for the city of Los Angeles, 80% of Los Angelinos didn't even bother to vote for one of the most important city executives in the United States. That's terrible. And our international institutions are not of the greatest. All of these things, the institutions that will affect whether we change or whether we collapse in a crisis, are going to be the subject of my next book. So come back in 2018 and we'll see what I've learned.
Well, that sounds terrific. And we certainly appreciate you being on the show this morning. I wish we had a whole lot more time, because we just scratched the surface. But you are an excellent guest, and I thank you and look forward to your next book.
Thank you very much.
All right. Goodbye, Dr. Jared Diamond. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning author and a celebrated scientist. He's currently professor of geography at UCLA. His latest best-selling book is called The World Until Yesterday. He joined us from St. Louis Public Radio. And he's going to be speaking at Unity Temple on Wednesday. Rainy Day Books is sponsoring that event, and we'll give you the details at the end of today's show. From bands, tribes, clans, and tribal societies, we move to modern American society to discuss the problem of bullies, in this case, adult bullies. Some thoughts on how widespread the problem is in the workplace and what you can do to protect yourself from being a victim. I'm Bill Anderson. This is Central Standard on KCUR.